5. And the Paris Masses complete. 6,000 men, 4,000 National Guards, and 2,000 troops of the line sailed from France in 15 ships to finish with all this quarreling between the slave owners in San Domingo and to suppress the Black Revolt. The commissioners were Sontenac, a right-wing Jacobin, friend of Brissot, Polverel, who had moved the expulsion of Barnave and his friends from the Jacobins and was also a follower of Brissot, and one Aillot, a non-entity. For the task in hand, the expedition was adequate, but it could not escape the division which was tearing all France after July 1789. The commissioners were revolutionaries. The commanding officers were officers of the king. Before the boat left, Desparbes, the commander, quarreled with the commissioners about precedence and addressed to the troops equivocal and unconstitutional words. They quarreled so loudly that it was heard by the officers and men. They quarreled again over the method of landing, and they split as soon as they landed. The National Guard were civilians of the revolution. The troops were soldiers of the king. As soon as Desparbes landed, instead of mobilizing all his forces for an attack against the slaves, he conspired with the local royalists, and the National Guards were distributed among the various camps under royalist officers. The commissioners carried the revolution on board with them. They went to meet it. But what was of infinitely more importance for the slaves, they had left it behind them. They had sailed from Rochefort in the middle of July. Before they reached San Domingo, the Paris masses, tired of the equivocations and incompetence of the parliamentarians, had taken matters into their own hands and dragged the Bourbons off the throne. To escape from the demands of the peasants, the wish of the workers that a maximum price be fixed for foodstuffs, and the other burning questions of the revolution, the Girondins, 17 days after the decree of April 4th, plunged the country into war with Austria. The army was half royalist, half revolutionary. Marie Antoinette was sending the war plans to the enemy. Revolutionary France seemed unable to organize itself, and the royalists in France were awaiting the entry of the foreigners to rise and massacre the revolution. The Girondins, afraid of the counter-revolution, but more afraid of the Paris masses, would not take steps against the royalists, and the people of Paris, goaded to exasperation, stormed the Tuileries on August 10th. They imprisoned the royal family, the legislative was dissolved, and a new parliament, the National Convention, was summoned. The masses administered a rough justice to the royalist plotters in the September massacres and took the defense of France into their own dirty but strong and honest hands. The Girondin government proposed to leave Paris. The workers forbade it. They armed 2,000 volunteers a day, and, with the royalists in their rear, quiet for a long time to come, went singing happily to drive the counter-revolution from the soil of France. If revolutionary France was saved, it was due to them. What has all this to do with the slaves? Everything. The workers and peasants of France could not have been expected to take any interest in the colonial question in normal times, any more than one can expect similar interest from British or French workers today. But now they were roused. They were striking at royalty, tyranny, reaction and oppression of all types, and with these they included slavery. The prejudice of race is superficially the most irrational of all prejudices. And by a perfectly comprehensible reaction, the Paris workers, from indifference in 1789, had come by this time to detest no section of the aristocracy so much as those whom they called the aristocrats of the skin. On August 11th, the day after the Tuileries fell, Page, a notorious agent of the colonists in France, wrote home almost in despair. One spirit alone reigns here. It is horror of slavery and enthusiasm for liberty. It is a frenzy which wins all heads and grows every day. Henceforth, the Paris masses were for abolition, and their black brothers in San Domingo, for the first time, had passionate allies in France. The National Convention would be elected and would deliberate under the influence of these masses. The slaves in San Domingo, by their insurrection, had shown revolutionary France that they could fight and die for freedom. And the logical development of the revolution in France had brought to the front of the stage masses who, when they said abolition, meant it in theory and in practice. But it takes organization and time to translate mass feeling into action. And for the moment, the revolution had more urgent matters than slavery to deal with. Neither the new commissioners nor the people of San Domingo knew anything about August 10th, when the commissioners landed on September 18th. They had come mainly to deal with the mulatto question. To their pleased surprise, they found that settled. 3 years of civil war, 1 year of the slave revolution, had taught these white planters some sense at last. As soon as the news of the decree arrived, all the whites, North, West, and South, accepted it. On July 14th, 1792, the whites gave the men of color a dinner. A few days later, the men of color returned it. The governor, the commander of the naval station, the treasurer, all wrote to the commissioners to say that all the whites had agreed to accept the decree. Naturally, there was still race prejudice. That cannot be destroyed in a day or in a year. But the whites wanted peace. And at the ceremonial reception, the white president of the assembly, the white mayor of Le Cap, all treated the quarrel with the mulattoes as a thing of the past. Two things troubled them. One was slavery. We have not brought 500,000 slaves from the coasts of Africa to make them into French citizens, said the president of the assembly to Sontenax, and Sontenax reassured him. I recognize, he said, only two classes of men in San Domingo, the free, without distinction of color, and the slaves. But the second question was the revolution. White cockades and red, each hoped for help from the commissioners. The royalists saw in the commissioners officials appointed by the king. The revolutionaries saw in them members of the Jacobin Club. Sontenax, as was inevitable in a Jacobin and a Brissotin, sided with the revolution. He reorganized the government to concentrate power in the hands of the commission and included in his council both mulattoes and a free black. The next step was now obviously the attack on the slaves before the troops began to feel the effects of the climate. But that vigorous attack was never made. Early in October, San Domingo heard the news of August 10th. This was no mere matter of loyalty to a monarch. The bourgeoisie throws over its king for a republic quickly enough if thereby it can save its skin and its goods. August 10th was more than that. It was the bid of the masses for power, not with speeches, but with arms. There could be no truce anywhere on French territory after August 10th. Royalists under Desparbes and revolutionaries under Sontenax sprang at each other's throats. The mulattoes fought for Sontenax, who was victorious, and deported Desparbes and the other royalist leaders to France. The revolution was triumphant. But Sontenax was determined to abolish mulatto discrimination. And the small whites and the rabble, although revolutionary, were furious at seeing the rich people of color high in favor with Sontenax. They raged with jealousy and race prejudice. Sontenax called them aristocrats of the skin and stood by the spirit and letter of the April 4th decree. Once more, the division between the rulers had given a further breathing space to the ruled. Yet this apparent good fortune was fundamentally no accident. The first sign of a thoroughly ill-adjusted or bankrupt form of society is that the ruling classes cannot agree how to save the situation. it is this division which opens the breach, and the ruling classes will continue to fight with each other just so long as they do not fear the mass seizure of power. The insurrection, nevertheless, now seemed at its last gasp. Lavaux, the French commander, even with his few soldiers, defeated Toussaint and drove the revolting slaves from their positions. Famine and disease were decimating their forces. Then it was that 15,000 men, women, and children, starving, with their soldiers defeated and driven into the mountains, came begging to be taken back. Toussaint and his trained band of a few hundred, little more than a year old, were helpless in the crowd. And Jean-François and Biassou, though superior in numbers, were weaker than he. Candy, who led a band of mulattoes, had deserted the blacks and joined the commissioners, beginning that mulatto vacillation which was to have such disastrous consequences in the future. Early in 1793, Lavaux was preparing a final assault to complete the rout of the insurrection when he was recalled by the commissioners. The revolution had overflowed the boundaries of France. On January 21st, 1793, the king was executed. The revolutionary armies were now winning successes, and the ruling classes of Europe armed against this new monster, democracy. In February came war with Spain, then with Britain, and it was to defend the coasts against the foreign enemy that Sontenac recalled Lavaux. The revolutionary tide flowed down into the plain once more, never again to lose heart, and Toussaint begins to emerge as the man of the future. For the moment, the blacks did not know where their true interests lay. And if they did not, it was not their fault, because the French Revolution, being still in the hands of liberals and moderates, was clearly bent on driving the blacks back to the old slavery. Thus, when the Spaniards in San Domingo offered the blacks an alliance against the French government, naturally, they accepted. Here were white men offering them guns and ammunition and supplies, recognizing them as soldiers, treating them as equals, and asking them to shoot other whites. All trooped over to join the Spanish forces, and Jean-François and Biassou were appointed lieutenant generals of the armies of the King of Spain. Toussaint went also, but he made his terms with the Spaniards as an independent leader, and not as a subordinate of Biassou. He had 600 men, well-trained and absolutely devoted to him, and he received an official title of colonel. Like all the other blacks, Toussaint attacked the godless, kingless republic and fought in the name of royalty, both Spanish and French. But for him, already, these slogans were merely politics, not convictions. It is his maturity that is so astonishing. Jean-François and Biassou were perfectly satisfied with their new official positions. But Toussaint proposed to the Marquis d'Hermona, his immediate chief, a plan for conquering the French colony by granting freedom to all the blacks. D'Hermona agreed, but Don Garcia, the governor, refused. Foiled here, before June, he wrote to Lavaux. He had not yet been with the Spaniards 4 months, offering to join the French and fight against the Spaniards if Lavaux would recognize the liberty of the blacks and grant a plenary amnesty. Lavaux refused, and Toussaint, baffled, remained with the Spaniards. But things went from bad to worse with the French, and on August 6th, Chanlat, a mulatto officer, one of Sontenac's creations, offered Toussaint the protection of the Republic if he would bring his forces over. In politics, all abstract terms conceal treachery. Toussaint refused and blandly replied that the blacks wished a king and that they would lay down their arms only when he had been recognized. Doubtless, Chanlat thought him to be an ignorant and fanatical African. For many historians, even after studying Toussaint's career, have still continued to believe that he had some African faith in kingship. Nothing was further from Toussaint's mind. Though allied to the Spaniards, he continued boldly to rally the blacks on the slogan of liberty for all. On August 29th, he issued a call. "Brothers and friends, I am Toussaint Louverture. My name is perhaps known to you. I have undertaken vengeance. I want liberty and equality to reign in San Domingo. I work to bring them into existence. Unite yourselves to us, brothers, and fight with us for the same cause, etc. Your very humble and very obedient servant, signed Toussaint Louverture, General of the Armies of the King for the Public Good." This curious document shows that already Toussaint had changed his name from Breda to Louverture, and already had reason to expect that his name was known. But what is most noteworthy is the confidence with which he is riding two horses at once. He uses the prestige of his position as General of the Armies of the King, but he calls on the Negroes in the name of liberty and equality, the watchwords of the French Revolution, of which royalty was the sworn enemy. Neither would help his aims, so he was using both. Sontenac's continued to rule with sternness in the north, the whites sullenly accepting the victory of the revolution, the mulattoes grabbing greedily at all government posts. Sontenac, though later he would be disgusted with this greediness, leaned on them and deported for trial in France all who smelt of counter-revolution. Just at this time, there arrived from France Galbaud, appointed governor in place of de Blancheland, arrested and sent to France by Sontenac. When Galbaud reached Le Cap, Sontenac was at Port-au-Prince, visiting Polverel. The whites of Le Cap, nearly all for the counter-revolution, gave Galbaud, who had property in San Domingo, a tumultuous welcome. Sontenac and Polverel knew what this meant, and hurrying from Port-au-Prince, dismissed Galbaud and his staff and put them on a vessel to be taken to France. But Galbaud was not going so easily. The sailors in the fleet took his part. He landed with a force. The whites of the counter-revolution joined him, and together they drove the commissioners and their forces out of the city. Sontenac, facing defeat and extermination, gave orders that the slaves and prisoners of Le Cap should be armed, at the same time promising pardon and freedom to the insurgent slaves who surrounded the city. He unloosed the lot at Galbaud and the whites. Galbaud's sailors, drunk with victory and with wine, had just turned from fighting to pillage when 10,000 blacks swooped down from the hills onto the city. The road from the heights ran along the seashore, and the sailors who remained on the ships in the harbor could see them hour after hour swarming down to Le Cap. The counter-revolution fled for the harbor, leaving all behind them. Galbaud had to throw himself into the sea to get to a boat, and to complete the royal discomfiture, fire broke out and burnt two-thirds of the city to the ground, destroying hundreds of millions worth of property. 10,000 refugees crowded onto the vessels in the harbor and set out for the United States of America, the great majority of them never to return. It was the end of white domination in San Domingo. That is how white San Domingo destroyed itself. The current legend that the abolition of slavery resulted in the destruction of the whites is a shameless lie, typical of the means by which reaction covers its crimes in the past and seeks to block advance in the present. In May 1792, the whites were all tumbling over each other to give rights to the mulattoes, and Room says that when the decree of April 4th arrived, they published it the day after. It was too late. If they had done it a year before, at the outbreak of the slave revolution, they would have been able to master it before it spread. Why didn't they? Race prejudice? Nonsense. Why did not Charles I and his followers behave reasonably to Cromwell? As late as 1646, 2 years after, Marston Moore, Mrs. Cromwell, and Mrs. Ireton had tea with Charles at Hampton Court. Cromwell, great revolutionary but great bourgeois, was willing to come to terms. Why did not Louis and Marie Antoinette and the court behave reasonably to the moderate revolutionaries before August 10th? Why indeed? The monarchy in France had to be torn up by the roots. Those in power never give way and admit defeat only to plot and scheme to regain their lost power and privilege. Had the monarchists been white, the bourgeoisie brown, and the masses of France black, the French Revolution would have gone down in history as a race war. But although they were all white in France, they fought just the same. The struggle of classes ends either in the reconstruction of society or in the common ruin of the contending classes. The French Revolution laid the basis of modern France, the country as a whole being strong enough to stand the shock and profit by it. But so corrupt and rotten was the slave society of San Domingo that it could not stand any strain and perished as it deserved to perish. Sontenac's return to Le Cap, a town half ruined. To his surprise, the pillage over, the revolted slaves did not stay with the commissioners. Gathering up their plunder, they went back to their roving life in the hills and to their Spanish allies. The French sent envoys to win them over, but all of them, Toussaint included, replied that they could only obey a king, and they would only recognize the commissioners when they had a king, which piece of sophistry had been carefully taught them by the Spaniards. The royalist officers were deserting Sontenac's for the Spaniards, and now, to complete the difficulties of the commissioners, the slaves who had not yet revolted, kindled by the revolutionary ferment around them, refused to be slaves any longer. They crowded the streets of Le Cap, exalted as at a revivalist meeting, and called for liberty and equality. On plantations which had hitherto escaped destruction, it was the same. The white slave owners who remained in San Domingo had learnt much in the last 2 years. One of them, who owned hundreds of slaves, told Sontenac's that it would be best to declare abolition. Sontenac's learned that Jean-Francois was about to rally the blacks to his standard by calling them all to liberty. Hemmed in on all sides and looking for support against the enemy at home and the enemy abroad, Sontenac declared the abolition of slavery on August 29th, 1793. It was his last card, and he could not help himself. In the West Province, Polverel, although dissatisfied, accepted the decree and persuaded the whites who remained not to oppose it. For the time being, having no other alternative, they accepted. But the decree was a failure. Those freed by Sontenac remained always faithful to him. But Jean-Francois, Biassou, and the other experienced soldiers remained in alliance with the Spaniards, and Toussaint, though not faithful to the Spaniards, still refused to go over to the French. In the south, the slaves had revolted against both whites and mulattoes, and were winning great victories. But in the west, the mulattoes were still dominant. Rigaud and Beauvais, with their white allies, had long since captured Port-au-Prince. Chasing the royalists away, the mulatto army established a mulatto domination. But when the fighting was over, they chose some of the bravest slaves and offered them freedom if they would lead the rest back to slavery and keep them in order. The offer was accepted, and 100,000 slaves were led back to their plantations, the inevitable fate of any class which allows itself to be led by another. Sure of their slaves, many of the mulatto proprietors in the West, though having the government in their hands, were furious at the decree of abolition and abandoned the revolution to which they owed so much. Property, white and mulatto, had come together again under the flag of the counter-revolution. Sontenac tried desperately to win over the black slaves. But despite all the overtures by Lavaux, urging the decree of abolition as evidence of goodwill toward the blacks, Toussaint would not join the French. His band was growing fast now, not only in numbers but in quality. Many of the deserting royalist officers, instead of joining the Spanish forces, preferred to join a troop of blacks who had formerly been French, hoping to gain influence over them and use them for their own purposes. They joined Toussaint's band. From them, he learned the orthodox military art, used them to train his troops, and organized an efficient staff. There were no maps of the district. He called together the local inhabitants, learnt from them the geography of their neighborhood, and from his early dabblings in geometry was able to construct useful maps. One of his guides was Dessalines, unable to read or write, his body scarred with strokes from the whip, but a born soldier, soon to hold high command. Toussaint's forces grew, as much by his fearless fighting as by his mastery of politics and intrigue. Lieutenant Colonel Nulli, having deserted to Toussaint, the French appointed Brandicourt in his place. With 300 picked men, Toussaint prepared an ambush for Brandicourt. As Brandicourt's men approached, they were not fired upon, but challenged. "Who goes there?"
"France."
"Then let your general come and speak to ours. No harm shall befall him." Brandicourt, who was in the center, ordered an attack, but his men begged him to parley with Toussaint. As soon as Brandicourt went forward, he was seized and brought before Toussaint, who commanded him to write an order to his forces to yield. In tears, Brandicourt wrote to Paco, his second in command, that he was a prisoner, and left it to him to do what he thought fit. Toussaint tore up the letter and insisted that Brandicourt should write a direct command to lay down arms. Brandicourt wrote, and on getting the letter, Paco, who was secretly in touch with Toussaint, said to the other officers, "Do what you like. I shall surrender." The three detachments joined Toussaint's forces without a blow. When Toussaint returned to camp leading these white troops, his own men were so startled that he had difficulty in assuring them that the newcomers were allies, and his chief, Dermona, was equally astonished. This bloodless victory gave him Dondon. He marched on Marmalade, where a stern engagement lasted all day. Vernet, the mulatto commander, called a coward by Polverel, found himself in difficulties, and soon he deserted to Toussaint with 1,200 men. Toussaint took Ennery, and the commander of that fort joined him. There remained only Plaisance between him and Gonaïves, but he was driven back by a mulatto legion from the west, which recaptured Ennery. After a short respite to gather his forces, he retook Ennery, and in December 1793, he marched into Gonaïves. Going back, he took Plaisance, and Chanlat, the commander, joined him with all his troops. All the garrisons at Saint-Marc, Verrettes, Arcaille, in hopeless isolation, surrendered to Toussaint and joined his forces. The abolition of slavery, the basis of property in San Domingo, had weakened the morale of the Republican commanders, and between joining the counter-revolution under Toussaint and being massacred by his forces, the choice was easy, especially as the black general already had a great reputation for humanity, a very singular thing in the San Domingo of those days. Thus, in the early months of 1794, Toussaint held the cordon of the west from the Spanish colony to the sea, and had isolated the north province from the west and south. The Spaniards held every fortified post in the north province except Le Cap itself and two others, and all knew it was Toussaint's doing. Toussaint was still subordinate to Jean-Francois and Biassou, but he now had 4,000 men, and under him were blacks, mulattoes, and whites, former officers of the Ancien Régime and former Republicans. But the majority were black, and Dessalines, Christophe, and Moïse had been slaves. Toussaint was in undisputed command, already a master of the art of war and a skillful negotiator. But although he had fought under the flag of the counter-revolution, he knew where his power lay. And under the very noses of the Spanish commanders, he continued to call the blacks to freedom. Jean-Francois and Biassou, his rivals, were now the idols of the refugee French colonists. 2 years before, they would not even speak to them. But revolution is a great teacher. And these French planters, the new subjects of the King of Spain, as they called themselves, compared Jean-Francois and Biassou to the great generals of antiquity and looked to them to clear the mountains, reestablish order, and then take Le Cap. Biassou, Jean-Francois, and Dermona formed a plan of campaign, and Biassou began to group his forces, suppressing some of the camps Toussaint had instituted. Toussaint replaced the camps and raised the blacks. To the wrath and disgust of the colonists, he persisted in violating the sacred promises of the Spanish king by promising general freedom to all the slaves who had gone back to their duty and were preserving order. The colonists praised Biassou, whose conduct merited general admiration, but they cursed Toussaint and his liberty for all, called him a traitor to the king, and demanded his head. Toussaint exercised an extraordinary domination over all men with whom he worked, and the Marquis d'Hermona, who admired him greatly, either could not or would not do anything. And while Toussaint performed these miracles in the north, the British added to the complications by making an armed bid for San Domingo, now apparently without defense. From the very beginning of the revolution, the planters had been throwing out threats that they would seek the overlordship of Britain. And after the slave revolt in 1791, they offered the colony to Pitt. But San Domingo was hardly Africa or India, where one raided at will. Interference would mean war with France. The British therefore refused, but busied themselves with schemes and plans of conquest. In December 1792, Lieutenant Colonel John Chalmers, an expert on West Indian affairs, wrote a memorandum to Pitt on what he called the vast, vast importance of San Domingo. "The deplorable situation of the French West Indies," said Chalmers, "seems loudly to crave the protection of Great Britain." And oddly enough, this protection promised to be most profitable. "The advantages of San Domingo to Great Britain are innumerable and would give her a monopoly of sugar, indigo, cotton, and coffee. This island for ages would give us such aid and force to industry as would be most happily felt in every part of the empire. It would prevent all migration from all the three kingdoms to America, which, without such acquisition, will keep pace and augment with the prosperity of America so as to become truly alarming and detrimental." Chalmers shared advanced British opinion on the decline of the British West Indies. "The West Indian possessions of Great Britain are comparatively deficient, diminutive, widely extended, and therefore little capable of defense." Here was a chance to remedy this sad state of affairs. By an alliance with Spain, offensive and defensive, the two countries could keep France and America out of the West Indies and secure themselves there. Britain should try to get the whole of San Domingo, but should circumstances of the United Powers decide the whole to be too ponderous for her political scale, she must at all events retain the north part of the island. The patriotic colonel ended on a characteristic note. "Gloomy and perilous as the present state of Europe is, yet from these evils, the greatest and most lasting benefits may arise from a brief, well-conducted war, terminated by a happy pacification. It is therefore humbly hoped that the belligerents will see the strong necessity of confining her, France, to limits as established at the death of Henry IV, adding thereunto all her foreign dominions, San Domingo and the Isle of Bourbon excepting." Colonel Chalmers's anxiety about the vast, vast importance of San Domingo was quite unjustified. Those were Pitt's sentiments exactly. The moment war seemed imminent, Dundas dispatched 4 French colonists to Williamson, the governor of Jamaica, with a letter of introduction. Immediately after the declaration of war, negotiations were begun, and on September 3, 1793, capitulations were signed. The colony would accept the protection of Great Britain until the peace. Modifications would be introduced in the exclusive, but the Ancien Régime would be reestablished, slavery, mulatto discrimination, and all. Clarkson and Wilberforce were left to bewail and bemoan the peculiar lukewarmness Pitt now showed for the cause he had advocated so urgently a few years before. If ever there was a good thing, this looked like one. Petitions from all parts of the island assured the British that they would be welcomed by all persons possessing property. And who else in San Domingo mattered? All expenses were to be repaid from the revenues of San Domingo. General Cuyler told Dundas that he entertained no apprehensions of our successes in West Indies. Pitt and Dundas pressed the expedition on, with a reckless disregard even for the safety of Britain. Dundas was very nearly out of temper at some delay. For Pitt, the West Indies was the first point to make certain. What San Domingo meant in those days can be judged from the fact that though a French invasion threatened Britain, even that was not to delay the dispatch of the expedition. Additional exertions will then be necessary to make the country take care of its own internal defense. 2 years later, this same Dundas would tell Parliament that the war in the West Indies was, on the part of this country, not a war for riches or local aggrandizement, but a war for security. Dundas knew that not a single member of Parliament would believe him. But Parliament has always agreed to speak in these terms in order to keep the people quiet. On September 9th, the British expedition of 900 men left Jamaica and landed at Jeremie on the 19th. Property owners are the most energetic flag waggers and patriots in every country, but only so long as they enjoy their possessions. To safeguard those, they desert God, king, and country in a twinkling. All propertied San Domingo rushed to welcome the British, the defenders of slavery. Soldiers like the brothers Rigaud and Beauvais and the detachments they commanded, politicians like Pinchonet, stayed with the French. But the mulatto proprietors, particularly those of the West Province, preferred their slaves to liberty and equality. All the fighting round Port-au-Prince was forgotten. When Beauvais remonstrated with Savary, mulatto mayor of Saint-Marc, Savary did not disguise his views. So long as the proclamations of the civil commissioners assured a happy and prosperous future, I carried out all their instructions. But from the moment I saw that they were preparing the thunderbolt which is bursting on all sides, I took measures to safeguard our fellow citizens and preserve our property. Auger's brother went with Savary. With such a welcome, nothing could stop the British. By the beginning of 1794, they were in possession of the whole seaboard of the Gulf of Port-au-Prince, excepting the capital, the whole of the West Province, most of the South, except for a small territory held by Rigaud's troops, and the important fortress of Mole San Nicolas. From the other West Indian islands came even more startling news of the triumph of Britain and the counter-revolution. On February 3rd, a British force of 7,000 men and 19 vessels sailed from Barbados and in 2 months had captured Martinique, St. Lucia, and Guadeloupe. Williamson, governor of Jamaica, had information that in Le Cap itself, all the people of property, the phrase is his own, were waiting to receive them. He wrote to Dundas of the prodigious trade they were now doing with San Domingo and hoped that the trade would correspondingly improve British revenues. Dundas congratulated him heartily on this surprisingly quick success. It was a crucial moment in world history. If the British could hold San Domingo, the finest colony in the world, they would once more be a power in American waters. Instead of being abolitionists, they would be the most powerful practitioners and advocates of the slave trade, on a scale excelling anything they had ever done before. But there was another, more urgent issue. If the British completed the conquest of San Domingo, the colonial empire of revolutionary France was gone. Its vast resources would be directed into British pockets, and Britain would be able to return to Europe and throw army and navy against the revolution. Sontenac, Paul Varel, and Laveau knew this and fought to save San Domingo for the revolution. If it is necessary to hide in a double and triple range of hills, said Sontenac to his followers in Le Cap, I will show you the way. We shall have no other asylum than cannons, no other food than water and bananas, but we shall live and die free. The British tried to bribe Laveau, for revolutionaries were, of course, low fellows who act as they do for money or ambition. Laveau, a nobleman under the old regime, called out Major James Grant, who, however, declined. Let us perish, citizen, wrote Sontenac to one of his officers. Yes, let us perish 1,000 times rather than permit the people of San Domingo to fall again into enslavement and servitude. If we are defeated, we shall leave for the English only bones and ashes. The British called on him to surrender Port-au-Prince. With a handful of men, he disdainfully refused, and the British retired. But at the end of May, a united force of British soldiers and French émigrés attacked the town. Traitors let them into an important fort on the outskirts, and Sontenac and Paul Varel, escorted by Beauvais and a small detachment of blacks, fled to Jacmel. It was June 4th. And the English celebrated the capture of the capital on the birthday of the king. The rest now was only a matter of days. Toussaint, a Spanish officer and therefore ally of the British, saw all his secret hopes being wrecked by the British victories. He was following the progress of abolition in England. But from the time there seemed a real possibility of getting San Domingo, the abolition bill began its long career as a hardy annual. French Republic, British constitutional monarchy, Spanish autocracy, though one might smile and another frown according to the exigencies of the moment, none troubled to disguise that, in the last analysis, the Negro could expect either the overseer's whip or the bayonet. Once the British were masters of San Domingo, then Spaniards and British would turn on the blacks and drive them back into slavery. Sontenac had abolished slavery, but he had no authority to do so. It was the Republican government in France alone which could decide this, and the Republican government spoke no word. Despite the feeling for the slaves in France, the convention did nothing for over a year. As long as Brissot and the Girondins remained in power, no word would be said about the slaves. But Brissot and his party could not last. They would not check the speculations of the bourgeoisie with the currency. They would not fix maximum prices for food. They would not tax the rich to pay for the war. They would not pass the legislation necessary to abolish the feudal dues. They would not ratify the seizure of the land by the peasants. Being afraid of Paris, they would not bring the whole country under a strong central government. And despite incessant royalist insurrection and plotting, they stuck to a federal system whereby the bourgeoisie in the provinces would be beyond the control of revolutionary Paris. They it was, and not Robespierre and the Mountain, who instituted the revolutionary tribunals, aimed not against the counter-revolution, but against all who proposed any agrarian law or any other law subversive of territorial, commercial or industrial prosperity. Robespierre was no communist, but he was prepared to go further than the Girondins, and the masses, who by now knew what they wanted, turned from the Girondins and gave their support to Robespierre and the Mountain, the extreme left. Dumouriez, the Girondin general commanding in the field, deserted to the counter-revolution. The Paris masses, deserting the Paris Commune, hitherto the real revolutionary center of Paris, organized an independent center of their own, the famous Évêché, and on May 31st and June 2nd, with firmness but great moderation, made the Girondin leaders retire from the convention, placing them only under house arrest and offering hostages out of their own ranks as guarantees for their safety. When history is written, as it ought to be written, it is the moderation and long patience of the masses at which men will wonder, not their ferocity. The Girondin escaped and, going to the provinces, joined the counter-revolution. In those difficult days, Robespierre and the Mountain gave France a strong government. The convention abolished the feudal laws at last, put an end to the most crying abuses, and won the confidence of the people. Despite the political intrigues of the leaders, the government, while hostile to communism, took the people into its confidence, for it had nobody else to depend upon. A rare exaltation of sacrifice and devotion moved through revolutionary France and Paris. As in Russia under Lenin and Trotsky, the people were told honestly of victory or of defeat. Errors were openly acknowledged. And where to this day reaction can only see a few thousand people who fell under the guillotine, Paris, between March 1793 and July 1794, was one of the supreme epochs of political history. Never until 1917 were masses ever to have such powerful influence, for it was no more than influence, upon any government. In these few months of their nearest approach to power, they did not forget the blacks. They felt towards them as brothers, and the old slave owners, whom they knew to be supporters of the counter-revolution, they hated as if Frenchmen themselves had suffered under the whip. It was not Paris alone, but all revolutionary France. Servants, peasants, workers, the laborers by the day in the fields, all over France were filled with a virulent hatred against the aristocracy of the skin. There were many so moved by the sufferings of the slaves that they had long ceased to drink coffee, thinking of it as drenched with the blood and sweat of men turned into brutes. Noble and generous working people of France, and those millions of honest English nonconformists who listened to their clergymen and gave strength to the English movement for the abolition of slavery. These are the people whom the sons of Africa and the lovers of humanity will remember with gratitude and affection. Not the perorating liberals in France, nor the philanthropy plus 5% hypocrites in the British Houses of Parliament. This was the France to which, in January 1794, three deputies sent by San Domingo to the convention arrived. Belay, a Negro slave who had purchased his freedom, Mills, a mulatto, and Dufay, a white man. On February 3rd, they attended their first session. What happened there was quite unpremeditated. The chairman of the Committee on Decrees addressed the convention. "Citizens, your Committee on Decrees has verified the credentials of the deputies from San Domingo. It finds them in order, and I move that they be admitted to their places in the convention." Camboulet rose. "Since 1789, the aristocracy of birth and the aristocracy of religion have been destroyed, but the aristocracy of the skin still remains. That too is now at its last gasp. And equality has been consecrated. A black man, a yellow man, are about to join this convention in the name of the free citizens of San Domingo." The three deputies of San Domingo entered the hall. The black face of Belay and the yellow face of Mills excited long and repeated bursts of applause. Lacroix of Ouray-et-Loire followed, The Assembly has been anxious to have within it some of those men of color who have suffered oppression for so many years. Today, it is two of them. I demand that their introduction be marked by the President's fraternal embrace. The motion was carried amidst applause. The three deputies of San Domingo advanced to the President and received the fraternal kiss while the hall rang with fresh applause. Next day, Belay, the Negro, delivered a long and fiery oration, pledging the blacks to the cause of the revolution and asking the convention to declare slavery abolished. It was fitting that a Negro and an ex-slave should make the speech which introduced one of the most important legislative acts ever passed by any political assembly. No one spoke after Belay. Instead, Levasseur of Sarthe moved a motion. When drawing up the Constitution of the French people, we paid no attention to the unhappy Negroes. Posterity will bear us a great reproach for that. Let us repair the wrong. Let us proclaim the liberty of the Negroes. Mr. President, do not suffer the convention to dishonor itself by a discussion. The assembly rose in acclamation. The two deputies of color appeared on the tribune and embraced while the applause rolled round the hall from members and visitors. Lacroix led the mulatto and the Negro to the president, who gave them the presidential kiss when the applause started again. Cambon drew the attention of the House to an incident which had taken place among the spectators. A citizeness of color, who regularly attends the sittings of the convention, has just felt so keen a joy at seeing us give liberty to all her brethren that she has fainted. Applause. I demand that this fact be mentioned in the minutes, and that this citizeness be admitted to the sitting and receive at least this much recognition of her civic virtues. The motion was carried, and the woman walked to the front bench of the amphitheater and sat to the left of the president, drying her tears amidst another burst of cheering. Lacroix, who had spoken the day before, then proposed the draft of the decree. I demand that the Minister of Marine be instructed to dispatch at once advices to the colonies to give them the happy news of their freedom, and I propose the following decree. The National Convention declares slavery abolished in all the colonies. In consequence, it declares that all men, without distinction of color, domiciled in the colonies, are French citizens and enjoy all the rights assured under the Constitution. Gone was all the talking and fumbling, the sabotage of Barnave, the convenient memory of the Brissots. In 1789, Gregoire had proposed equality for mulattoes and gradual abolition. He had been treated as anyone would be treated who for the Union of South Africa today proposed merely social and political equality for educated Africans and relief from the slavery of the past laws for the rest. Like Gregoire, he would be denounced as a Bolshevik and would be lucky to escape lynching. Yet when the masses turn, as turn they will one day, and try to end the tyranny of centuries, not only the tyrants, but all civilization holds up its hands in horror and clamors for order to be restored. If a revolution carries high overhead expenses, most of them it inherits from the greed of reactionaries and the cowardice of the so-called moderates. Long before abolition, the mischief had been done in the French colonies, and it was not abolition, but the refusal to abolish which had done it. At that time, slavery had been overturned only in San Domingo of all the French colonies, and the generous spontaneity of the convention was only a reflection of the overflowing desire which filled all France to end tyranny and oppression everywhere. But the generosity of the revolutionary spirit was at the same time the soundest political policy. Robespierre was not present at the session and did not approve of the step. Danton knew that the convention had been swept off its feet by an excess of feeling and thought that it ought to have been more cautious. But that master of revolutionary tactics could not fail to see that the decree, by ratifying the liberty which the blacks had won, was giving them a concrete interest in the struggle against British and Spanish reaction. "The English are done for," he shouted. "Pitt and his plots are riddled." But while the revolution swelled with justifiable pride, the rich fumed, remaining shameless and obstinate. As soon as the decree was passed, the maritime bourgeois sent to the deputies of the convention an address on the occasion of the enfranchisement of the Negroes. "Bravo! 100 times bravo, our masters! This is the cry with which all our places of business resound when the public press comes each day and bring us details of your great operations. Certainly we have all the time to read them at leisure, since we have no longer any work to do. There is no longer any shipbuilding in our ports, still less any construction of boats. The manufactories are deserted, and the shops even are closed. Thus, thanks to your sublime decrees, every day is a holiday for the workers. We can count more than 300,000 in our different towns who have no other occupation than, arms folded, to talk about the news of the day, of the rights of man, and of the Constitution. It is true that every day they become more hungry, but whoever thinks of the stomach when the heart is glad?" The convention, bourgeois itself, was not too happy after the first excitement was over, but the masses and the radicals hailed the decree as another great clearance in the forest of abuses. It is not known exactly when the news reached the West Indies, but on June 5th, the day after the celebrations of the King's birthday and the capture of Port-au-Prince, the English commanders at St. Kitts heard that 7 French ships had escaped the British fleet and landed at Guadeloupe. In command was Victor Hugues, a mulatto, one of the great personalities of the French Revolution to whom nothing was impossible, taken from his post as public prosecutor in Rochefort and sent to the West Indies. Hugues brought only 1,500 men, but he brought also the convention's message to the blacks. There was no black army in the Windward Islands as in San Domingo. He had to make one out of raw slaves. But he gave them the revolutionary message and dressed them in the colors of the Republic. The black army fell on the victorious British, began to drive them out of the French colonies, then carried the war into the British Islands. Toussaint got the news of the decree sometime in May. The fate of the French in San Domingo was hanging by a thread. But now that the decree of Sontenac was ratified in France, he did not hesitate a moment, but at once told Lavaux that he was willing to join him. Lavaux, overjoyed, accepted the offer and agreed to make him a brigadier general, and Toussaint responded with a vigor and audacity that left all San Domingo gasping. He sent to the destitute Lavaux some good ammunition from the Spanish stores. Then he persuaded those of his followers who were with him to change over, and all agreed. French soldiers, ex-slaves of the rank and file, and all his officers, blacks and white royalists who had deserted the Republic to join him. His demeanor at mass was so devout that Dermona, watching him communicate one day, commented that God, if he came to earth, could not visit a purer spirit than Toussaint Louverture. One morning in June, Toussaint, having communicated with his usual devotion, fell on the startled Biassou and routed his troops. Then in a campaign as brilliant as the one by which he had captured the line of camps for the Spaniards, he recaptured them for the French, either conquering them or winning over commanders and men, so that when he joined the French, he had 4,000 troops. The North Province was almost recaptured, and the Spaniards, Biassou, and Jean-Francois were not only routed, but demoralized. The British, having received some overdue reinforcements, were already calculating how much of the conquered San Domingo they could wangle from their allies, the Spaniards. "In these matters, the more we have, the better our pretensions," wrote Dundas to Williamson. On them, just about to swallow the prize, Toussaint turned with one of his tigerish leaps. he captured all their positions on the right bank of the Artibonite, drove them across the river, and but for a succession of unexpected misfortunes, would have taken their stronghold of Saint-Marc.